are buried. We need to dig down to get at them. The original Kristang installed the projectors, charged up their capacitors, activated a stealth field to fool subsurface scans, and then covered them with soil. Trees have grown up on some of them since then. Emby told me that when a projector is ready to fire, explosive charges will blow the soil away and the maser cannon muzzle projects above the surface, so we don't need to clear all that dirt away. What we do need is to dig a shaft down about 80 meters to access the power controls. The Kristang made these things go dormant when they left. Emby says we need to physically reattach power leads, something like that. They'll walk us through it when we get down there. Ma'am, Shauna said, I've seen so much crazy shit out here that I'm ready to believe anything. But if this Emby is really a group of native Ruha, why aren't they reactivating the projectors by themselves? I asked myself the same question, Jarrett, Perkins admitted. My guess is either this Emby is a very small group, maybe even a single Ruhar, and they need our help. They can't trust any other Ruhar, but they can trust us because they know we are totally screwed if the Kristang take control of this planet. Or it could be that Emby wants to avoid getting in trouble if this whole operation goes south. The only thing I do know is that if there is any chance we can keep the Kristang away from this planet, I'm going to take it. Same here, Shauna agreed. Growing tomatoes is not why she left Earth. You can get us transport, ma'am? No, Perkins shook her head. But Emby can. We will need a pilot. I know a pilot, Shauna said with a smile. There are a lot of pilots, Perkins noted. Can we trust him? We can trust her, Shauna insisted. I know she would do anything to fly again. That's the problem, ma'am. She doesn't fly now. How is she going to get a buzzard? That will be Emby's problem. We'll have transport, Dave said. Where are we going to get a drilling rig, and someone to operate it? That is going to be a little more difficult, Perkins acknowledged. There were drills on Paradise. The Ruhar used them to dig wells for irrigating farmland. While they were not plentiful, they would also not be locked up and well guarded, as there normally wasn't any point to stealing a drill. The real problem was going to be finding a complete drilling rig that could be broken down to fit inside the cargo compartment of a truck or a buzzard. A buzzard was big. It could carry two Hamvees easily, so cargo capacity and weight were not the issue. What she did not know was what was the minimum length of a disassembled drill. She would need to ask Emby. Surely the hamsters knew the answer, or could find it. Well, Skippy, I said after we read the message from Perkins to Emby. Perkins has a very good point. Are there any drill rigs that can fit inside a buzzard?
Yes, duh. I already thought of that, Joe.
There is a type of compact drill rig that was designed specifically to break down to be transported by a buzzard in one flight to service remote areas. It will certainly fit in a truck.
Oh, great. I was relieved. That is a question that I should have asked earlier. How many of these compact drill rigs are there on Paradise?
Three.
Three? On a whole planet? Holy shit. We have to steal one of only three special use items? Where are they right now?
One is being used to dig a well in the northwest corner of what UNEF calls Backstratchiscan, about as far from Lemuria as you can get without going to an island. Another is at an airfield about 500 kilometers away from the active drill being held in reserve in case of a problem with the first drill. The third is in a military warehouse on an airbase near the base of the space elevator.
You're kidding me. Two of them are way too far away, and the third is secured by the military. How the hell are we going to get one then? How is Perkins going to get one? You have a plan for that? Is Perkins going to drive up to the airbase gate and ask for it politely, or, hey, I was on a roll. Maybe she can order it off the Ruha version of Amazon.
Yes.
Yes, yes to what?
The last one, Joe. The compact drill rig will be delivered to her wherever she needs it. It's a high-dollar item, so shipping is free.
That is a good point. We should probably get someone to sign for it. I paused to collect my thoughts.
Skippy, I apologize. I should have known you would have a plan for this. Would you please, please, share your brilliant plan with us?
You didn't say pretty please with sugar on it, Joe.
Let's pretend I did. Fair enough. What I'm going to do, Joe, is to utilize the awesome power of bureaucracy. Count Chocula would appreciate this. I'll send a very official-looking equipment requisition to the airbase logistics officer. It will order that drill rig and everything else Perkins will need to be loaded onto a truck and delivered to some remote warehouse, wherever Perkins needs it. When the logistics officer calls headquarters to verify, like the good little soldier he is, I will handle the call myself and chew him out for not having moved the drill rig already.
That is a brilliant plan, Skippy. I wasn't being sarcastic. Uh-huh. We'll let bureaucracy work in our favor for a change. The Ruha guard aboard the train was supposed to check on the humans every 4 hours, although there didn't seem to be much point in doing that. The train was taking the humans where they wanted to go, back to Lemuria. The only source of human food in the area was the nutrient mush that was locked in a cabinet. Optimal security measures would not have put all the mush containers in a cabinet in the same train car the humans occupied, but that was more convenient when it was time to feed them. And to the Ruha, the mush had an unpleasant smell. Best to keep it away from the Ruha passengers, few though they were. So when it was time for the guard to sleep, he set an alarm on his phone to wake him in 4 hours. Skippy, of course, deactivated that alarm, and when the guard awoke briefly 6 hours later, the clock on his phone told him he had been asleep for only 3 hours. Satisfied, he rolled over in his bunk and drifted off to sleep again, lulled by the gentle rockin' motion of the train. Before their Ruha guard had locked the door of the train car behind him, Perkins and her team had settled down to sleep for the night, or they had acted as if they were settling down for the night. As soon as the guard was gone, they quickly got their boots back on. Within 15 minutes, Perkins received a message that the guard had gone to sleep. "How does MB know that?" Dave asked in a whisper. "They must have someone aboard this train," Shauna guessed. "Makes sense," Major Perkins nodded and turned, as with a soft click, the cabinet containing all the canisters of yummy nutrient mush unlocked. Moving quietly, the team unloaded the canisters and rolled them up in the satchels they had made from a roll of cloth. Then they waited. They waited 32 minutes, with Perkins chafing at the delay, until MB signaled it was time. The train was slowing as it climbed a steep hill out of a river valley. They had heard the wheels clatter over a bridge shortly before. MB warned that the train would pick up speed again when it reached the top of the short grade, and the safe place to jump off the train was less than 100 meters long. For 100 meters, there was a field of Ruha crops alongside the tracks. Then the tracks were hemmed in by trees. Perkins got her team ready. Jesse volunteered to go first. "I'll go first, then you jump and I'll catch you," he gallantly told Shauna. "Screw that," Shauna said and dropped to the ground. She hit feet first, letting herself roll, mowing over a row of crops and getting a mouthful of dirt. She sprang to her feet and gave a thumbs up, barely able to see the other three faces in the open door of the train car. Then she crouched to avoid being seen as she watched one, two, three others jump lightly and roll. Ski went last, hanging onto a railing and making sure the door closed behind him quietly and securely before he jumped. He almost left it too late. When he finished rolling, he was a mere 10 meters from a stand of trees. They all waited for the blinking blue light on the rear of the train to disappear. Perkins smoothed out the dirt where she'd fallen and propped up the crops she had flattened. Hopefully it would be a while before the farmer noticed the damage. The others followed her example. Then they assembled. "What's next, ma'am?" Dave asked. He stood on his left foot, favoring his right. "Are you mobile, Chaika?" Perkins asked. "Yes, ma'am." Dave rotated his ankle. "Tweaked my ankle. It'll be better when it's warmed up." "Good." Perkins checked her Z-phone and indicated the forest on the other side of the tracks. "MB says we go that way. We need to hustle, and no using lights until we're out of sight." She pointed to the lights of the farmhouse behind them across the field. "Use the low-light camera of your phone to see. Jarrett, you take the lead." Shauna nearly poked her eyes out by colliding with low-hanging branches in the dark, before remembering to hold a hand up in front of her face. Her other hand held her Z-phone with its rear-facing night-vision camera pointed forward. The phone feature was supposed to be used with goggles. Here they had to try walking through feet-tangling underbrush while looking at a small screen. The four stumbled slowly and awkwardly through the forest in darkness, made worse because it had begun to drizzle. When Major Perkins in the rear announced she could no longer see the lights of the farmhouse, she allowed the team to use their Z-phones as lights on a low setting. Now that they could see, they made rapid progress through the forest, guided by maps on their Z-phones. MB contacted Perkins twice, urging her to move faster. When they came upon a road, they broke into a steady run, and soon, Perkins was grateful for the drizzling rain. It soaked her hair, making her short ponytail hang limply against the back of her neck. The rain also cooled her, running through the warm and humid night air. "Hold here," Perkins said in a harsh whisper as her Z-phone beeped with a warning message when they neared a bend in the road. "Truck coming! Off the road!" she shouted. They ran through the woods into a stand of bushes and lay flat, phone lights off. The electric motors of Ruhar trucks were quiet, and the gently falling rain muffled sound, so they saw the truck's headlights eerily casting beams through the trees before they heard the vehicle. It approached from beyond the curve, lights bouncing as it moved fast along the rough dirt road. The truck slowed as it approached, making Perkins fear that the Ruhar had discovered their escape and tracked their location by Z-phone. Maybe Embi was not as smart as they said they were. The truck slowed to a crawl, and Perkins' mind raced. If the Ruhar knew where Perkins and her team were, should they run or surrender? Surrender seemed to be the smart play, because if Embi couldn't even cover their escape from a train, it was unlikely Perkins could complete a complex mission of awakening buried maser cannons. Had she been a fool for believing a mysterious benefactor? Was the whole situation some elaborate joke or a setup to embarrass UNEF? No. The truck had slowed only to negotiate the sharp bend in the road and a deep puddle. Even at reduced speed, the truck's tires threw up a splash as it hit the puddle, briefly obscuring the headlights. Then it cleared the curve and accelerated, speeding onward through the rainy night. Perkins rose to her feet, brushing mud from her uniform top. "Ma'am," Jesse whispered in the utter darkness, echoing Perkins' own fears. "I thought they knew we were here." "Apparently not. Embi would have warned us," she said hopefully. "Back to the road. We need to make up time," she ordered, as Embi sent another message urging them to hurry. She turned her Z-phone light back on and they ran fairly hard down the road another 2 kilometers. Perkins was winded, and she noted the 3 younger people were also breathing hard. Life as a farmer didn't leave much opportunity for running. They came over a slight rise in the road and saw the lights of a small village. Just ahead, the forest gave way to fields of crops growing in straight rows. "Stop here," she ordered, rechecking the message on her Z-phone to make sure she hadn't missed anything. "There's a village up ahead. Embi says they're all asleep. There's a train coming soon." Her phone was counting down from around 7 minutes. "It will slow down when it goes through the village. The residents don't like noisy trains while they're trying to sleep." She smiled, and Ski almost laughed. The tracks are about 0.5 kilometer ahead, although she couldn't see anything in the rainy night. "We're supposed to wait behind a shed next to the tracks, then we climb on as it goes by. The last 10 cars are empty. Embi has unlocked the doors. Coulter, you go first this time. The rest of us try to get on the same car. If not, get on top and go forward or back to whatever car Coulter gets onto." "Ma'am," Jesse asked, "in the dark, how do we know which are the last 10 cars?" Dave looked through his Z-phone's night vision feature. "I can see good enough. The train cars were big, about 80 feet long. I'll count off for you." "You better be right about it, Ski," Jesse said. Jesse grabbed a handrail beside a door, and hanging on with one hand, he slid the door open and tossed his satchel in. Running alongside, the other 3 threw their satchels in the open door, then Jesse helped Perkins up into the doorway. Shauna stumbled over a rock but caught the handrail, then Jesse got hold of her arm and swung her inside. Dave almost made it, running on a gimpy ankle, but he tripped and fell flat. Jesse almost jumped out to help his friend before Dave got to his feet and caught the handrail of the next car, waving Jesse off. Making up for falling in the dirt, Dave shimmied up the handrail to the roof of the car, then crawled on hands and knees to the car ahead. Awkwardly, he slid down feet first until Jesse and Shauna grasped his legs, then he let go of the roof, and the 3 fell to sprawl inside the empty car. The train was beginning to pick up speed as Perkins closed the door, making sure it was closed all the way. Snapping on her light, she looked around the inside. There was some trash, such as straps, packing material, and busted cardboard boxes. Otherwise, it was just empty, scuffed, and well-used composite material. "Chaika, your ankle is worse than you told me?" "No, ma'am," Dave said defensively. "I tripped on a rock or something. I'm squared away." Perkins was not entirely convinced. "Take your boot off and I'll look at it. Embi says we'll be here until about mid-morning." Dave untied his boot and laughed. "What's so funny?" Shauna asked. She didn't see much humor in their situation. "We hopped aboard a freight car. We've got no jobs and no money." Dave reached in his satchel and pulled out a can of nutrient mush. "And all we have to eat is beans. We're hobos." "Hey," Jesse offered a fist bump and Ski accepted. "Brother, Jesse said with a wry smile. First hobos on an alien planet. That's gotta count for something. Around mid-morning, the train slowed suddenly. Embiid told Perkins the train's locomotive would experience a temporary mechanical difficulty while going around a curve. When the train slowed enough, Perkins and her team were to get off on the outside of the curve where the engineer and the locomotive couldn't look back and see them. When the train was down to a slow walking pace, the four humans bailed out, being careful not to injure themselves as the area was thickly forested. They dashed into the woods and lay down. As soon as they were hidden, whatever Embiid had done to the locomotive fixed itself and the train picked up speed again. Once the train had gone out of sight and could barely be heard, Shauna stood up carefully. "Ma'am," she asked Major Perkins, "who is this mysterious benefactor? The engineer of that train is one of them? Or they can remotely control anything on this planet?" "Yeah," Jesse added. "And how did Embiid know that truck was coming down the road last night? Or that everyone in the village where we hopped that train," he pointed down the tracks, "was asleep?" "People, I worked intel, and not knowing the identity of our mysterious benefactor is bugging the shit out of me," Perkins admitted. "If we're successful, we may find out someday. If this mission isn't successful, I have a feeling Embiid will bail on us real fast. I'm not doing this for Embiid, whoever they are. I'm doing this to give UNEF a chance, even a tiny chance, to avoid being slaves of the lizards. You still in?" "Oh, hell yes, ma'am," Jesse nodded. "I can't remember the last time I didn't have a bad feeling about a mission." They walked off and on, taking short breaks until late afternoon, then Perkins declared a rest. MB insisted they were safe, but Perkins ordered everyone to take 45-minute shifts as sentry to be sure. She took the first shift, and her own eyelids were heavy when Chika took over. It felt like she had just gotten semi-comfortable on the ground when Jarrett shook her awake. "It's time, ma'am," Shauna said quietly. With long practice from her military career, Perkins came to alertness. The sun had set, so it was dark, with clouds covering the sky. At least it wasn't raining. Rubbing her eyes to make them focus, she immediately checked her Z-phone. There were no new messages from Embiid, but as she turned her eyes away from the screen, a new message appeared. "Everything is on schedule," the message read. "You have 56 minutes to travel the last kilometer." "How did you know that I just woke up?" Perkins typed suspiciously, and even before she hit the send button, there was a reply. "Your phone moved and you activated it to check messages, Major Perkins," the message read. "You and your team should eat now. This is going to be a long night." Giving up on MB revealing any more information about their sources and methods, Perkins sat on a log. "Eat up, people. We need to get moving soon, and this is going to be a busy night." Dave reached into his satchel and pulled out one of his dwindling supply of nutrient mush cans. "I hope Embiid gets us more food along with transport and a drill rig, ma'am." Perkins nodded. "Embiid says they've got it covered. They know we can't eat the native life or Ruhar food." Shauna popped open her can of mush and looked at it without interest. She tipped her head back and swallowed it as quickly as she could. Running a finger around the bottom to get every last drop, she made a face. "Sure, Embiid will get us food, enough to carry out the mission. Then they won't need us." "We have to take that risk," Perkins agreed grimly. "Ha," Jesse laughed. "We're sneaking around between two advanced species that can blast us from orbit. Maybe we'll get lucky, and we'll take a railgun dart before we starve." "Amen to that, brother." Dave popped open a can of mush. "Maybe I'll shoot myself if I have to survive on this crap much longer." According to MB, their mission that night was simple. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of a village was a truck loaded with the portable drilling rig and boxes containing human food, real food, from Earth, mostly canned or MREs. All Perkins and her team needed to do was get into the warehouse, which was unlocked. Then they would start the truck, roll aside the big door, drive the truck out, and slide the door closed behind them. To cover the sound of the truck, MB would create a distraction. A ventilation fan in a barn on the other side of the village would overheat and begin making a terrible screeching racket. Then the fan's motor would catch on fire. That would keep the hamsters busy while the humans drove away with their prize, and they would keep driving, all night. "It will be suspicious for a truck loaded with human food to go missing," Perkins typed. The remaining supply of human food from Earth had to be a small, carefully guarded item. How could such a valuable thing be sitting unguarded in a warehouse? Again, before she hit the send button, there was a reply. The boxes of human food are mislabeled, Emby said. No one knows they are in that truck. We only took a small amount of your food. It will not be missed, and no one will be going into that warehouse for weeks. How did you arrange that? Perkins asked. Humanity is not the only species with a cumbersome bureaucracy, Major Perkins. It is easy for things to get lost. This is a big planet. You need to get moving. Perkins explained the plan to her skeptical team. Just like that, ma'am, Jesse asked. This Emby gift-wrapped a truck for us? Just like that, Perkins confirmed. Emby has done right by us so far. I'm going to trust them, whoever they are. Chapter 16. It was as easy as Emby said it would be. The side door of the warehouse faced the village, so they slipped in one at a time, with Shauna going first. She got inside, closed the door behind her, and scanned the inside first with night vision, then risked using her Z-phone's light. It was a barn that had been turned into a warehouse. It still smelled like wet dirt and grain. In the center was a large truck with an extended cab and six wheels. The back was covered with a sort of tarp. She carefully swung the tailgate down and peeked inside. The back was fairly crammed with large pieces of equipment, boxes, and extra fuel cells. Emby had told the truth so far. To be certain, she climbed into the truck bed and slowly opened one of the boxes. Food. Real, honest-to-God human food from Earth. The box contained cans, tins, pouches, and MREs, all with French writing. Shauna felt a pang of hunger, just glancing at the food. Real food. She dropped to the ground and called Perkins.
It's as Emby said, ma'am. Everything is here.
When all four of them were inside, Perkins climbed into the cab and turned the truck's main power on. It showed ready to start. Jarrett, you drive first. Coulter, Chaika, get ready to slide the door open. Jarrett, make sure the headlights are switched off. On her Z-phone, Perkins typed, ready. Commencing distraction now. Drive slowly until you get over the bridge, Emby replied. Muffled by the walls of the barn, a screeching sound began. Faintly, then growing louder, it was a high-pitched, grinding sound of metal on metal. With the side door of the barn only cracked open, Perkins saw lights come on in the village's dozen homes. Within 5 minutes, hamsters were running toward the barn with the faulty ventilation fan, which had now burst into flames. This would be a good time to go, Emby sent. Chaika, Coulter, get that door open quietly.
Yes, ma'am, Jesse replied.
While they were waiting, Jesse had found a can of oil or some kind of lubricant, and he and Dave had liberally applied it to the door's wheels and tracks. It slid aside almost silently, and Shauna hit the truck's starter. With only a faint whine from its electric motors, the truck came to life. The big truck was a tight fit through the door. Perkins walked backwards in front of her, guiding Shauna to squeeze the truck through the door. Perkins kept glancing nervously toward the other end of town where the fan fire had been extinguished and the screeching noise was winding down. Once the truck cleared the big door, she motioned for it to be closed and they climbed into the cab. Shauna drove slowly, with the lights off, across a bridge, Perkins holding a Z-phone in front of Shauna's eyes so the driver could use the night vision feature. Fortunately, within half a kilometer of crossing the bridge, the road took a sharp turn, and Perkins allowed Shauna to turn the headlights on the lowest setting. After another kilometer and an all-clear message from Emby, Shauna increased the headlights' brightness and stepped on the accelerator pedal. According to Emby, they had about 600 kilometers to cover within the next 7 hours before dawn. Emby directed them on a slightly roundabout route to miss driving through villages, although they could not avoid passing an isolated house here and there. Perkins debated whether to turn the headlights off when passing inhabited houses, then decided that would look suspicious. A truck driving through the night was, after all, nothing unusual. They were just an ordinary truck, she reminded herself. There should be nothing interesting about it. As they drove, the sky cleared, and Perkins saw the eastern sky becoming pink almost an hour before dawn. With only 40 minutes until the sun cleared the horizon, Emby directed them to pull off the main road onto an overgrown track. They bumped along the rough road with overhanging tree branches scraping the top of the truck until they came to a halt under two large trees.
Jesse and Dave went back to cover their tracks, while Perkins and Shauna cut branches to drape over the truck. "You should rest now," MB messaged. "We will alert you if anyone approaches your position. You will be moving again in 9 hours. "We will be driving during daylight?" she asked. "Yes. This area is sparsely populated and air traffic is minimal. You are on the edge of a no-fly zone agreed by the Ruhar and the Kristang," MB stated. "You must remain hidden now because a road convoy is scheduled to pass by a crossroads roughly 10 kilometers ahead of you in 5 hours, and the road will be busy." "Understood." "MB wants us moving again in 9 hours, so I want us to get sleep and be ready to go in 7 hours," Perkins said. They had taken turns driving through the night, giving two people at a time the ability to catch sleep in the back seat. "Can we eat first, ma'am?" Shauna asked. The thought of the real food in the back of the truck had been in the back of her mind all night. "Good idea. We should check out the sumptuous buffet MB set up for us. We will all split one item this morning," Perkins warned. "Our stomachs aren't used to real food after eating mush for too long." Dave was the first to look in the box that Shauna had opened. "This is all in French. I think boeuf means beef, ma'am." "Don't ask me, Chaika. I learned Mandarin Chinese, not French," Perkins replied. "That sounds right to me." "Does everyone want to try beef stew? I think that's what this is." Dave held up a can. "Anything but chicken, man," Jesse replied. "That would be way too tempting if we ever get back to Fort Rakowski." They split one beef stew and 3 cans of nutrient mush. Everyone agreed the stew was awesome. The next 2 days involved driving part of the days and all of the nights. They were climbing up through foothills that became hills. The roads became more and more rough. In some cases, the big truck was mowing down bushes. Only once during daylight did MB warn them about aircraft approaching, and they had to pull the truck under a stand of trees and cover it as best they could. They never saw an aircraft. MB said it passed over several kilometers to the south. That incident made Perkins more suspicious about who MB could be. Their mysterious benefactor was not concerned about the truck being detected on sensors, but was worried about an aircraft flying overhead and someone looking down through a window. Perkins could understand MB having some control or influence over Ruhar sensor coverage, but why wasn't MB concerned about their truck being seen by the Kristang ships in orbit? It made no sense. She knew not to bother asking MB for answers because MB wasn't going to provide answers. Their destination was a clearing deep in the woods, off the road. The truck was designed to drive off-road, but MB advised they might need to cut down a few trees along the way. In the back of the truck was a cutter device that attached to the front of the truck and chainsaws. MB had planned a detailed route to the clearing and tried to assure Perkins getting the truck there was manageable. The clearing was a good place to stash the truck and wait for a buzzard to arrive. She would believe that when a stolen buzzard landed in the clearing. And she would believe MB when she saw a giant maser cannon buried 80 meters under the surface of paradise. "Uh-oh, Joe," Skippy announced. "Aw, crap. Skippy, can I get through one day without bad news? I had spent a boring day watching Perkins' truck driving along a lonely road." "One day. Is that too much to ask? Really?" "Don't ask me, Joe. The universe apparently hates you." "Why? What did I ever do to the universe?" "Maybe you cut it off in traffic, or took its parking space, or, oh, maybe you dated the universe's sister. Hey, maybe the universe is a girl you dated. That is a surefire way to get anyone to hate you, Joe." "No, Skippy, girls I date don't hate me. They just think I'm, you know, meh." "Meh is still better than let's be friends, right?" "Nothing is worse than the let's be friends speech." I shook my head, and in the corner I could see Adams's shoulders shaken with mirth. "What fresh bad news do you have for me today?" "The Kristang are planning some bad things in Lemuria, Joe." "They can't do anything in Lemuria," I protested. "The terms of the ceasefire state that humans are a neutral party and are not to be harmed or used by either side. They also can't be assisted by either side." "I know what the ceasefire terms say, Joe, and so do the Kristang. Unfortunately, the ceasefire terms do not prevent either side from inspecting human-occupied areas to assure that humans are not stockpiling banned weapons or some bullshit excuse like that. Basically, one of the Kristang commanders is bored and he wants some action. So his plan for this inspection tour is to provoke a group of humans into attacking his team,
Then he can hunt unarmed humans in the jungle for sport. He will be wearing powered armor with a rifle and air support. Messages I have intercepted state that he intends to land somewhere with a mixed gender population and then accidentally kill or injure several women. He knows this would likely provoke human men to hostile action, which the Kristang see as a weakness, by the way. If they are unable to provoke a sufficiently hostile action, they will simply make something up and kill humans anyway. Shit. My thoughts exactly. Whew. I let out a long breath and sat back in my chair. Anything we do to stop the Kristang would risk exposing our presence here, so I would have to clear it with Chotek first. He's not likely to approve any action. Unless, you know, it were to totally slip my mind, I added with a meaningful glance at Sergeant Adams.
Sir, I can't hear very well. I think my ears are clogged, she said, rubbing an ear.
Damn, I am glad that I brought Adams along.
Ah, that is too bad, Sergeant.
Skippy, how are the Kristang getting to Lemuria? A trio of dropships will be leaving the Kristang base in the morning.
Skippy, if those dropships were to suffer fatal mechanical failures at high altitude, I would not lose much sleep over it, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, Joe. However, it is not so simple. As I have explained before, Kristang's systems are hardened against cyber attack because they are wary of interference by their patrons, the Theranin. Most critical control systems aboard Kristang dropships are at least partly manual. Also, their base is a great distance from here, which sometimes limits my abilities in this sort of thing. However, I can promise you that I will do my best. I will get working on it immediately. This type of interference takes a great deal of time. I do not know whether the time available is sufficient for me to accomplish anything effective. It would be best if you began trying to think of an untraceable way to warn the humans on Lemuria. Or something else. Overnight, we weren't able to think of a good way to notify UNEF of the danger from a Kristang hunting party. I didn't get much sleep, and when I did sleep, I had nightmares of terrified men and women running through the jungle, being hunted like animals. The problem with sending any message to UNEF was that the Kristang would certainly learn about it and assume the Ruhar had warned the humans. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, warning UNEF would count as the Ruhar assisting the humans. With that part of the ceasefire having been violated by the Ruhar, the Kristang would then be free to assist the humans in whatever way they felt like. The only plan we had, in case Skippy wasn't able to do anything, was to track the dropships and try to predict where they would land. Then we would send a warning just to the people in those specific villages. It wasn't a good plan, and part of me was thinking that if the Kristang planned to land in a village populated by idiotic keepers, maybe I shouldn't warn those assholes. But I would warn them anyway. The keepers may be unforgivably stupid, but they were humans. With 5 minutes before the hunting party dropships were scheduled to take off the next morning, Skippy told me he was still working on it, and that it would help if I would shut the hell up and stop distracting him. That worried me. I had rarely seen Skippy concentrate so hard on anything. 2 minutes to go. Skippy, how are we doing? We? We aren't doing anything. I'm doing all the work while you sit there trying to decide whether to pick your nose or not.
I decided against it, and all of Paradise rejoices at your decision.
Seriously, how are you doing?
Watch your laptop screen, Joe. The action is about to start. No coming attractions, just the main feature that I call a very bad day at the office. Oh, it's starting now.
The lead dropship, with the Kristang commander aboard, was the first to take off. The dropships were ugly things, with small wings tipped with V-shaped winglets. The Kristang optimized their dropships for combat in the vacuum of space. The aerodynamics were not the best. The first dropship lifted about 10 meters off the ground and hovered while I guess the pilots were checking their systems. Then it increased power and climbed, at first at an angle, then it zoomed straight up fast. To my eyes, too fast. It started to wobble. And when it got to what looked like 300 to 400 feet, it flipped over on its back and fell straight down like a rock. Skippy kept a running commentary.
Ooh, see, Joe, you're not supposed to fly straight up like that. You're supposed to clear the airfield perimeter and then gain altitude. Otherwise, something like this could happen.
Wow, this looks like it might be painful.
The dropship crashed on its back right on top of another dropship and broke into 3 pieces, with burning chunks flying around from both dropships.
Yep, that's definitely painful.
Oh, would you look at that. Now the third dropship is on fire, he said as a big chunk of flaming debris hit the third dropship, which had just tried to lift off to get out of the danger zone.
Hey, good for them. Some lizards survived from that third dropship, and they're out and sort of crawling away.
Uh-oh. A tall light pole that was at the edge of the tarmac had been struck near its base by a piece of debris, and it wobbled. Then, slowly at first and picking up speed, it toppled over, with the heavy lights smashing right onto one of the crawling Krestang.
Oh, that had to hurt. I'm no expert, Joe, because I don't feel physical pain, but I'm thinking that pretty much had to hurt real bad, right?
Yep, that guy's not moving. Those other guys really should move faster. I have a feeling the missiles on the racks of that dropship have become unstable. We'd better go to super slow motion on this video, Joe.
As he said that, three missiles that had been trapped under the third dropship ignited and streaked away, just as the third dropship exploded.
Wow!
Two of the missiles bounced and skidded across the tarmac. One hit a large building, and the other flew in the yawning open door of a hangar. Both buildings blew sky high as the missile warheads detonated. There were secondary explosions from the hangar as whatever had been in there blew up. We barely had time to take in that super slow-mo video when the camera view switched to the third missile, which had gone in the other direction, across the tarmac. Across the tarmac, between two buildings, flipping over high into the air, doing cartwheels, and then plunging downward. Down directly in the open door of the Krestang's ammunition bunker, and down the underground tunnel.
Wow, now there is something you don't see every day, Skippy commented.
What are the odds of that, huh?
That was poor operational security by the Krestang, I think, leaving the bunker door open like that.
3, 2, 1. The underground ammo dump blew, and the video feed cut out. The video then switched to a view from high above. Skippy must have hacked into the sensors of a Krestang ship in orbit. All we could see was the top of an angry, growing mushroom cloud where the base had been.
Holy shit, Skippy, I said, stunned.
Adams couldn't believe it either, and Desai had her hand in front of her mouth.
Golly, I hope those lizards who were crawling away from that dropship are okay, Skippy said seriously.
Although, to tell the truth, I wouldn't get my hopes up for them.
Gosh darn it, that was a truly unfortunate series of events, I guess.
Well, shit happens, right?
Overkill is underrated, I guessed. I have no idea what you're talking about, Joe. However, I can say it is unlikely that any assholes from that base will be going on hunting trips in Lemuria anytime soon.
That was a nice touch, having the light pole fall on that guy, Adams observed.
Huh? Skippy asked. Nope, that was sheer blind luck, Sarge Marge. As you understand luck, anyway. I couldn't have planned something like that. That guy must have some seriously bad karma built up from a past life. Or this one.
Thank you anyway, I said. Any chance this could have blowback on us or UNEF?
Thinking about that possibility, I feared that I really should have told Chotek about it beforehand.
Nah, zero, Joe. The opposite of infinity. To the Krestang, your species are primitive cavemen. No way would they ever consider lowly humans to be involved. Certainly, the Krestang might suspect this was not merely an incredibly unfortunate accident, but if they suspect anyone, they will suspect the Ruhar. They won't say that openly because the commander of that base is politically connected to senior clan leadership, and admitting that his poor security allowed the Ruhar to sabotage his equipment would be damaging. Even if they knew for certain that somehow the Ruhar were involved, they won't do anything that jeopardizes the ceasefire.
Hmm, I mused. If we somehow provided evidence that it was the Ruhar, that could get the Ruhar and the Krestang into the shooting war we want.
No. No, that won't work. I quickly discarded my own idea.
We need a shooting war that takes out the Krestang battle group, so the balance of power in the negotiation shifts back to the Ruhar, not just a ground war.
Damn it.
Okay, Skippy, I know you could not possibly have been involved in the extremely unfortunate accident we witnessed this morning.
Perish the thought, he said cheerily.
Joe, I suggest you practice your innocent face, because the light from that explosion will reach the Dutchman soon, and Chocula is sure to contact you about it.
Crap. I hadn't thought about that.
I'd better call him first, inform him that we detected a large explosion at a Krestang base, and that we know nothing about it.
Gosh darn it, Joe. It is truly too bad we don't have any video that could clue Chotek in about what caused the explosion, Skippy lamented.
That is too bad, I agreed. Hey, Joe,
After you call the count, how about you get some popcorn and we watch the video again? I have a feeling there are some surprises.
Surprises? We already saw what happened.
No, Joe, you dum-dum. I mean surprises for the Kristang. That hunting trip went terribly wrong, didn't it?
I called the Dutchman. Neither Chotek nor Chang sounded like they believed that we were not involved in the massive explosion. Chotek didn't directly accuse me of causing the incident, so I really didn't care. I was, however, put on notice that there had better not be any more such incidents.
Skippy, I don't think we can do that trick again. Not for a while, anyway.
No problem. Do not expect me to do that often, Joe. I got lucky this time. The pilot of that lead dropship practiced poor cybersecurity. He had been having trouble with new software of the dropship's navigation system, so he left it on overnight to run a diagnostic. I was able to partially get in that way, and it took me almost to the last second to get the details right. I wouldn't count on my doing that again.
Lieutenant Irene Strebick looked again at the message on her Z-phone in disbelief.
Explain this to me again.
Shauna took a breath before responding.
Which part? The part where you want me to steal a buzzard and fly you and your partners around on a secret mission. A mission you can't tell me anything about. I can't tell you until...
Shauna, stealing a buzzard isn't just difficult, it's impossible.
I know. I used to fly them.
Since the Ruhar took their aircraft back, they implemented security features. All pilots need a key card that is assigned to each authorized flight.
And a password. Plus, there is a biometric scanner. No human would pass the biometric check. If I somehow do get access, the startup procedure for a buzzard takes over 5 minutes, even for an emergency launch. During that time, someone at the airbase would hear. A buzzard sitting on the ground is vulnerable. I can't engage shields, weapons, or stealth until the ship is in the air. One rifle could take out an engine fan blade and the buzzard wouldn't be going anywhere. It's impossible.
It's not impossible. We can do it.
We? You mean these friends of yours that you can't tell me about?
Yes.
Irene, do you want to fly again?
Yes, of course I do.
If we can get you a buzzard, will you fly it for us?
Shauna asked. She had thought this would be easier. Irene didn't answer for a moment. Shauna asked another way.
If we can steal a buzzard, will that prove that we're real?
It will prove you can do the impossible.
Shauna, this mission, it's really that important. This isn't some crazy cowboy shit you've gotten into.
Irene knew that Shauna was as desperate for infantry duty as Irene was to fly again.
Irene, this mission could be everything for UNEF's survival. That's all I can tell you until you pick us up.
I don't believe this, Irene said almost to herself.
You got me. I'm in.
If you get me a buzzard to fly.
Deal,
Shauna said, and gave a thumbs up to Major Perkins. Perkins had been listening on her own Z-phone and returned the gesture. Skippy and I had been listening also.
They got us a pilot, Skippy. Now how do we get a buzzard for her?
She's in Lemuria. There aren't any buzzards there.
And what about all that stuff she said about it being impossible to steal a buzzard?
I assume you can get around the keycard and the biometric stuff, but is she right about how long it takes to start up a cold ship?
She is correct about that, Joe. Getting access for her is child's play for me, of course.
You didn't answer my question. What is your plan for getting around the startup time problem? Because if you're waiting for me to dream something up, I hate to disappoint you.
My own pilot experience was limited to Theran and dropships, and the normal startup procedure took over 7 minutes. It was possible to skip a lot of steps and go from activating the power to engines being able to fly in 4 minutes. That was the absolute fastest it could be done. There were too many systems that needed to power up in sequence to make the process go any faster.
This Irene person is right. It is impossible to steal a buzzard. As soon as any Ruhar at the airbase hear those engines starting, they will react, and this Irene won't get anywhere.
Oh, sure, Joe, if you do it the hard way. Duh. I plan to cheat.
Can you give me more details there, Skippy?
Simple. We'll have the Ruhar steal a buzzard for her.
Irene Strebick tried to relax in the back of the buzzard. The ship had showed up at her village that afternoon, and she had been ordered to come with them. It had happened exactly as Shauna told her it would, so she boarded the buzzard without question. There were only 3 Ruhar aboard, 2 pilots up front and 1 soldier watching Irene. The soldier seemed bored,
and told her only that they had been ordered to bring Shauna to their airbase. He didn't know why. Other than that, the soldier didn't want to talk. The ship droned on for over an hour. Irene calculated in her head that they had passed over the ocean and were now approaching, or already over, the coast of Tenturo. Shauna had told her to expect what happened next, so Irene was not worried when the droning of the engine stuttered, then cut out. The guard shook himself out of the half-asleep position he had been in and spoke to the pilots. Since the guard had taken her Z-phone, she didn't understand most of the hurried conversation, but she understood when the guard motioned for her to tug her harness tightly. The engines restarted, but surged, and from the tone, Irene could tell neither of the engines were developing much power. There was more conversation between the soldier and the pilots as the buzzard descended rapidly enough for Irene's stomach to flutter. Weight came back as the pilots slowed their descent and then flared for landing. The soldier braced into a crash position, indicating Irene should do the same. The soldier looked genuinely afraid, and Irene tried to mimic his expression, although he wasn't paying much attention to her. With a final roar of thrusters being used to provide emergency supplemental lift to the failing engines, the buzzard hovered for a moment, then set down roughly enough that Irene was glad she had been in a crash position. One, then the other engine shut down, and the cockpit door opened. Both pilots came out, worried expression on their hamster faces. They popped the side door latch and went out to inspect the ship. The guard unstrapped and walked toward the doorway to join them. When he saw Irene reaching for her own straps, he shook his head.
"You stay," he said in broken English, pointing to her seat emphatically.
Irene nodded and held up her hands as the soldier walked down the fold-out stairs. As soon as he was out of sight, she unbuckled her straps and got out of the seat as Shauna had instructed. So far, events had gone as Shauna said they would. Now was the critical moment. And right on schedule, there was a click sound as a locker door unlatched, just as Shauna said it would. Crouching to avoid being seen through the window, Irene went forward to the locker and pulled out one of the two rifles that Shauna had said would be there. Now, the last test. Irene selected the stun setting, flicked the safety off, and put her finger on the trigger. Normally, a Ruhar weapon would disable itself if touched by a human. This one stayed active. Confident now, although confident in who or what Irene didn't know, she checked again that the rifle was set to stun and popped her head up to glance out the small window. Both pilots and the soldier were standing together, a few meters in front of the left engine, looking at it and talking. Irene stepped into the doorway and was able to take aim before the soldier saw her out of the corner of his eye and reached for his pistol. It was too late for him. She stunned him with one shot, then switched aim to the two unarmed pilots. Moving more slowly and deliberately than she wanted to, she shot one pilot, then had to leap down the stairs to take aim as the other pilot ran out of sight behind the left engine pod. Irene shot him in the legs and he went down, sprawled full length in the grass. Following the instructions Shauna had sent to her, Irene took Z-phones away from two of the Ruhar and used the soldier's knife to cut away the locator beacons that were sewn into the collar of the pilot's jackets. Then she dragged first the soldier and the two pilots away from the buzzard so they wouldn't be harmed by the engine exhaust. The Ruhar were heavy. Irene was grateful for the hard work she'd been doing working on a farm. She left the pistol with the soldier and activated his Z-phone. As Shauna had said, the soldier's Z-phone now had only one function, a map. The map would allow the three Ruhar to walk to a village on the coast within a week. The three aliens began stirring awake, so she stunned them again, then went back into the buzzard and brought back a box of Ruhar field rations, three blankets, and a pack that contained useful items like a tarp, knives, and a shovel. The three Ruhar would be fine as long as they didn't stay in place waiting for rescue, because rescue would not be coming for them. Shauna's friends had somehow arranged to fake a buzzard crash over the ocean. Any rescue aircraft would be looking for wreckage far out at sea. Without the pilots knowing, the buzzard's transponder had turned off in the middle of the flight. Everything had worked exactly as Shauna told Irene it would. Now came the final test. She went back in the buzzard, secured the door, sat in the pilot seat, and took a deep breath. All the instruments were on and the controls didn't freeze when she touched the control stick. One of the biometric security features of a buzzard was a reader built into the control stick. It scanned the user's DNA to assure an authorized pilot was touching the controls. No way could a human pass a DNA scan. Yet Irene did pass the scan. All the controls still worked perfectly. And,
Oh, fuck me, Irene gasped. With a flicker, the cockpit displays all switched from Ruhar script to English. She had been trained to read Ruhar, but somehow the flight systems had reverted to the settings installed when humans had controlled aircraft on Paradise. Irene decided she could puzzle about that later, after she was in the air. The right, then the left engine started normally. Because the aircraft had just landed and systems other than the engines had not been shut down, she was able to go to full power and lift off in less than a minute. After reaching 100 meters, she circled the area to check that the three Ruhar were unharmed. They were, laying prone on the grass where she had left them. Irene pointed the buzzard's nose toward the coordinates Shauna had sent and kept the buzzard flying low and at a moderate speed. As soon as the system was ready, she engaged the stealth field, and suddenly the windows went dark as light was bent around the aircraft's hull. No matter. She was trained to fly on instruments. After setting the autopilot and verifying that all systems were operating normally, she pulled one of the two Z-phones out of a pocket. Shauna, it's Irene. I'm in the air. Great. You have a clear path to us. There aren't any aircraft along your flight path right now. The Ruhar have a dozen aircraft due in search and rescue where they think you went down over the ocean. All the cockpit displays are in English instead of Ruhar. How the hell did you do that? I didn't do anything. I told you we have friends. Everything went okay? Shauna knew it had, for Embi had sent them a message that Irene had successfully launched and was on the way to pick them up. Yes, everything went fine. I'll be there in, she checked the flight computer, about an hour. You're going to tell me what this top-secret mission is after I land. I will, and it's going to blow your mind, Shauna said with a laugh. Giant maser cannons, Irene exclaimed in disbelief.
Those are my words exactly, Lieutenant, Jesse agreed. Ain't that some shit?
And you think this mysterious benefactor is a group of native Ruhar who don't like their government trading away this planet?
We don't think that, we're guessing, Major Perkins corrected their new pilot.
Based on what MB has been able to do, the facts so far fit our guess. We're going to reactivate these projectors so we can shoot the Krestang battle group out of the sky? Irene asked.
That's the idea, Perkins agreed.
Yes, ma'am. Then we'll still have the problem of the Ruhar government wanting to sell Paradise to the Krestang, Irene said skeptically.
I believe Embi is hoping that if the Ruhar fleet has to fight for this planet again, they'll want to keep it. Right now, it's too easy for their government to take whatever they can get and bail on us, Perkins explained.
Are you regretting your decision to join us?
If Strebik wanted to pull out now, that was going to be a major problem. Perkins couldn't let her go anywhere or have access to a Z-phone.
No, ma'am. Irene shook her head emphatically. This is a little tough to take all at once. I hate the feeling of knowing those lizard ships are hanging above my head all the time. If we can do something about that, I'm all in. What's the next step?
You have got to be joking, Irene said with shock after Dave dropped the truck's tailgate and pulled aside the canvas flap. It was a big truck, and the cargo box was fairly jammed with boxes and equipment.
How is all of this crap supposed to fit in my buzzard?
It's not, ma'am, Dave said. Mostly we just need to take the drill rig with us. A lot of this, he pointed to the cargo box, is fuel cells for the truck and the buzzard, and we have, he hopped up into the cargo box and tilted it toward the pilot, food. Real food. He held up an American MRE pouch, then a package labeled chicken and dumplings. Irene gasped.
Where did you get that?
Dave shrugged. Embi had the truck loaded up like Santa's sleigh for us. There's also two full boxes with cans of nutrient mush, if you prefer that, ma'am.
No. Real food would be excellent, Irene said with delight. I guess that drill rig will fit. I'll have to see it.
Embi assured us that this type of portable drill rig was designed to be carried by a buzzard, Shauna assured the pilot. We practiced unloading and loading it yesterday. Embi even included the tie-down strap kit for securing the drill rig in the back of a buzzard.
You're sure about this? Irene asked,
because she was not sure at all.
Yes. Look, the cover comes off the truck's cargo box, and the truck has a crane for loading its own stuff. There was also a mini forklift kind of thing with treads so it can operate off-road. Plus, the drill rig is self-propelled.
The drill rig's base had 6 articulated legs so it could walk on its own just about anywhere.
Seeing the insect-like legs in action was spine-chillingly creepy at first, Shauna thought. There was no denying it was very effective. Irene looked at her buzzard, sitting under camouflage netting and tree branches. She would not be flying it again until after nightfall. Embi had confirmed the Ruhar still thought her ship had gone down over the ocean. They still had several aircraft flying search missions. And there was a full-scale investigation into how a buzzard had been sent to pick up a single human in Lemuria. Ruhar military command on the planet was not able to trace where the order had come from. According to Embi, they would never discover who had issued the order. To be safe, she was not going to fly until the early hours of the next morning. If you're sure, show me. Let's get it loaded. Chapter 17. To Irene's surprise, everything they needed for drilling down to the first projector fit inside the buzzard with room to spare. The Ruhar designers had cleverly packaged the portable drill rig so it collapsed on itself and could crawl up the buzzard's rear ramp on its own. They wouldn't be able to deploy the drill rig that way at a projector site, but it was still an impressive feat of engineering. Everything was squared away with 2 hours to spare, so the five caught a quick nap and were awakened in the pitch-dark night by a message from Embi. After a quick breakfast of nutrient mushes, they checked that the truck was securely hidden. Then Irene began walking around the buzzard for a pre-flight inspection.
"What kind of name is Strebik, ma'am?" Jesse asked as he held a light for their pilot.
He pronounced the name Strebik as Irene had done.
"It's German," Irene said as she opened an access panel and checked an actuator.
"German?" Jesse said, surprised.
"I know," Irene laughed and looked at her arm's light brown skin. "My father is German, and the joke was that I came from gypsies. My mother's name is Elena Ramos. She was in Germany with the army and married a German man over there."
"She was in the army, ma'am?"
Irene nodded. "She was a Black Hawk pilot. She's why I became a pilot. She retired only 3 years before the hamsters hit us." She frowned.
Now the Ruhar were the closest thing UNEF had to allies. Life was certainly strange sometimes.
"Before we left Earth, she talked about re-enlisting to join UNEF, but it would have meant 6 months of training and she might not get flight duty anyway. Sometimes I wish that I hadn't gotten the recall notice," Jesse said honestly. "My father, my uncle, my cousin and I were all about to head out on a hunting trip. We planned to be gone a week or more. We were loading the truck when my mother told me I had a message from the 10th Division on my email. My cousin told me to ignore it, but I knew I couldn't. If we'd gotten that truck loaded earlier, I might not have seen that message until it was too late to go off-world. There wasn't any cell phone service up in the hills back then."
"I didn't have a choice," Irene said as she closed the access panel. "I was already back with the 10th Aviation at Fort Drum when we got the order to deploy to Ecuador." She walked over to the left engine and pointed for Jesse to shine the light into the exhaust.
"How did you get involved with this?"
"Us?" Jesse asked.
"The four of us were all together because of Joe Bishop."
He told her the whole astonishing story as she finished the external pre-flight check.
"Do you think Bishop is really alive?" Irene asked quietly, trying to be sensitive that Jesse had been Joe's friend.
"Major Perkins says the hamsters think he is."
"Me?"
Jesse scratched his head.
"All I know is that Joe is one lucky son of a bitch. Always has been. He also has a nose for trouble. If there is trouble within 100 miles, you can be sure Bish will find himself in the middle of it sooner or later. What I can say is, I hope if he did find trouble, he didn't drag anyone else into it."
"He's right, Joe," Skippy said. "You sure dragged me and the whole merry band of pirates into a huge mess, didn't you?"
"Me?" I protested.
We had been listening to Jesse and Irene talk through their Z-phones, which they didn't realize were transmitting. I did feel guilty about eavesdropping. The reason I justified listening to them talk had been to prevent them from making mistakes they couldn't recover from.
"You were the one who got me into trouble, Skippy. If you hadn't opened the door to that warehouse, I would be on a farm in Lemuria right now."
"Or dead, I didn't say."
"Turn it off, please."
"Are you sure, Joe?"
"Yes. You're listening. You can tell us if they make a big mistake. It's creepy for me to be listening to them. I don't even know this Irene.
You read her service record and the profile I put together, Joe.
That's not the same as meeting her in person."
"I wouldn't know about that," said the beer can, who never actually met anyone in person.
Lieutenant Strebick is now in the cockpit and running her pre-flight checks there. I could tell her that I know everything is perfect with the aircraft, but a pilot would never take anyone's word about that, right?
You got it. I've only flown Theran in dropships, but before I fly, I am checking everything myself.
Understood. While we're waiting, Joe, I have a question.
Skippy, it is unlikely that I have an answer, especially if your question is about 17th-century Hungarian poetry.
No, it's nothing like that.
When you were at your parents' house, you borrowed your father's truck to drive into town.
Yeah, so? I can drive, Skippy. Although right then I wondered whether my driver's license had expired. I'd been away from Earth for a while, after all.
Your driving and piloting skills are debatable, Joe, but that is not my question. Why were you driving a truck? Why don't you have a Corvette?
A Corvette? That question completely surprised me. I can't afford a Corvette, Skippy. Besides, what would I do with a car like that in Maine? It snows there 6 months a year.
Why do you ask that?
I thought all astronauts drive Corvettes. Technically, you are an astronaut, Joe. You have flown spacecraft by yourself, and you even performed a space dive.
Huh. I never thought of myself as an astronaut, Skippy. Maybe you're right.
Maybe not. Real astronauts get laid a lot more than you.
That's because women know those guys are astronauts, Skippy. I can't tell anyone what we've been doing out here.
Also, astronauts are a lot cooler than you, Joe.
Goodbye, Skippy.
Sergeant Adams woke me and Captain Desai up early the next morning, as Perkins and her team approached the first projector site in the Buzzard. Many things could go wrong at this point. We all wanted to know what was happening in real time. I told Skippy to show us video from the Buzzard's cameras and sensors, and we would listen when they talked to each other on Z-phones. But we weren't going to eavesdrop this time.
"Are they clear?" Irene asked over the Z-phone earpiece.
The Buzzard's belly camera gave her a view beneath her, and Dave in the back was remotely aiming the camera where it needed to be. Still, with tons of equipment to be lowered to the ground, it made sense to be certain.
"Major Perkins confirms they are clear, yes. Should I begin lowering the sling now?" Dave asked.
"Do it. I want the drill rig on the ground before the wind picks up," Irene ordered. This whole operation was too complicated, but she didn't know an easier way. The Kristang had deliberately installed the projectors in remote areas that would be unlikely to be developed for habitation, industry, or agricultural use. In most cases, this meant that trees had grown over the sites during the intervening years, and there was no way to land the Buzzard at the sites without the laboriously slow process of cutting a clearing. With the Buzzard, they had flown to any clear area near the first site and lowered Perkins and Jesse to the ground on a cable. Those two then cleared just enough trees out of the way while Irene landed the Buzzard and she helped Dave and Shauna unload the drill rig and secure it in a sling. The drill rig and its associated gear was now awkwardly slung beneath the Buzzard and needed to be carefully lowered through the gap in the trees. The sun would be rising in less than an hour, so they needed to get the drill rig, Shauna, and Dave on the ground as quickly as possible. Then Irene would park the Buzzard close by, cover it with a camouflage net, and wait. While the four others drilled down to a hidden chamber where a secret giant maser cannon could be reactivated. The weather forecast from MB was favorable, except that Irene expected the light breeze to pick up and become unpredictably gusty as the sun came over the horizon. The drill rig needed to be on the ground and the sling cable retracted before then. If the wind was blowing too strongly for Shauna and Dave to be lowered to the ground by cable, Irene could land the Buzzard and those two could walk to the projector site. The sling with the drill rig was fitted with thrusters that could be steered remotely, or it had a limited ability to guide itself. Perkins and Coulter had hammered a target into the ground where they wanted the sling to make contact. The sling would home in on that spot. Irene only needed to hover the Buzzard over the opening in the forest canopy, and either Dave or the sling's automated guidance system would handle dropping the package. That was great news for Irene. She had limited experience with hauling cargo by sling, and no recent experience. It was nerve-wracking to hover the Buzzard, one eye on the instruments and one eye on the treetops to the east. When the wind kicked up, leaves on the trees to the east would flutter and signal when the wind would reach the Buzzard. Irene used the leaves to anticipate when she would need to maneuver the lumbering Buzzard. In training, she had been able to hover within a 2-meter sphere, never varying more than a meter in any direction. In training, she never had a multi-ton weight suspended on the end of a cable beneath her ship.
"Down. It's down," Shauna called over the intercom. "Cable released."
Irene had felt the cable go slack. She had been watching the camera feed to anticipate when to reduce power. She couldn't help allowing herself a self-congratulatory smile. The drop had been nearly perfect, despite the morning winds picking up already.
"Retract cable," she ordered. "Jarrett, Chaika, the wind is too strong for you two to rappel down. I need to land, and you can hike in."
"Yes, ma'am," Dave replied unhappily. Looking down at the waving treetops, he decided that maybe he shouldn't be unhappy about having to walk a kilometer or two through the woods that morning. "I'll inform Major Perkins." "No," Irene said flatly.
"No."
"I wouldn't be asking if," Shauna started to say.
"Shauna, no. No way. I became a pilot to be in the air, not underground."
"Irene, please think about it. None of us can do it. We tried. Even Major Perkins tried, and she's bigger than I am. If we have to lift the drill and start again, it will take another full day, and MB is already pushing us for being too slow."
"I don't believe this, Shauna."
It occurred to Irene then that under normal circumstances, Shauna should have addressed her as Lieutenant, or Ma'am, and she should have called the specialist Jarrett. These were anything but normal circumstances.
"What happens if I get stuck down there? Who will fly the Buzzard?"
Perkins' team had gotten the drill down 83 meters before it broke through to an open chamber, a chamber that didn't appear on their subsurface scans. Then they retracted the exploratory drill and fitted the widest drill bit available. It was slow going because of their inexperience with drilling, even with MB guiding them. More than once, MB had sent messages exhorting them to move faster. An exasperated Major Perkins had replied that if MB wanted them to drill more quickly, they should have sent someone with experience. Finally, after what Perkins knew was far too much time, the big drill was done. And then they discovered the problem MB had apparently not considered. None of the four drill crew members could fit down the hole. Shauna had tried first, but she was 5'7" and her shoulders simply were too wide. For once, she regretted the weight training she had done to qualify for infantry duty. The two men had made a half-hearted attempt to fit. Then Major Perkins had tried, but as she was 5'10", there was no way she would fit either. They were about to drill a second hole next to the first in order to widen the opening, when Shauna thought of their pilot. Irene Strebick was barely at the Army's minimum height requirement for pilots of 5'4", and that had been with her standing with perfect posture, stretching her neck. She was petite and slender, and she'd always been self-conscious about her diminutive size. Now, as far as Major Perkins and Emby thought, her petite frame was an asset.
"Shauna, there has got to be some other way to do this."
"Skippy, come on. Isn't there another way to do this? Does she really need to squeeze down that hole?" The thought of me doing that made my skin crawl.
"Another way like what, Joe?" Skippy asked, sounding annoyed.
"I don't know, like, can we do it remotely?"
"Gosh, Joe, I never thought of that. What a brilliant idea," he said sarcastically. "You know, I don't have the owner's manual for that type of Kristang projector, so I looked it up on YouTube. Half the links were people doing stupid stuff, like asking me if we can do this remotely."
"No, we can't, you dum-dum. The Kristang didn't want anyone waking up those projectors remotely. That's why they physically disabled them. Someone needs to go down there and reconnect the power connections and plug things in. I'd do it because I can fit down the hole easily, but darn it, I don't have thumbs, you jackass.
Sorry."
"Okay, send Perkins a message. Strebick needs to try. She isn't claustrophobic, is she?"
"Not according to her service records, but who wouldn't be claustrophobic while going 80 meters down a narrow, dark tube?"
"Crap. Ask her to try. If she can't do it, that's understandable." Irene's whole body was shaking when she felt her feet finally had room to move. She swung her feet around, trying to find some place to stand. The camera on the end of the drill had shown an oval-shaped chamber, which now had a cone of dirt below where the drill had punched through the composite ceiling. The cable continued lowering her, with her shoulders scraping the sides, even though she had her arms squeezed as tightly together in front of her as she could. Without being able to move her head enough to look down, and her eyes only inches from the tube's wall, she couldn't see anything at first. The drill had sprayed a coating on the wall that hardened and prevented the dirt and rocks from collapsing in on her. MB had said the coating was considerably tougher than steel. MB was not 80 meters down in a skinny hole. Light. Even looking straight ahead, she was able to see light coming up from below. Then her right foot touched something soft.
It was the cone of dirt. She continued descending, and both of her feet found solid ground. Then she was able to move her arms. Her shoulders screamed at her from being cramped in one position for so long, and her eyes blinked from the sudden, unaccustomed glare of the lights they had tossed down the hole. When she could stand, she managed to report in. "I'm down," she said, and tugged on the cable twice for emphasis. "No surprises here. It looks like it did from the camera. What does MB want me to do first?" Irene wanted to accomplish her tasks as quick as possible so she could clip the cable back on her harness and be pulled up. Up and out. "Outstanding, Strebik," Major Perkins replied. "Here's what you do."
"Success, Joe," Skippy shouted excitedly.
"I have established a link to the projector and I have complete control. All systems fully operational." "Who'd have guessed it? Lizards can build some good stuff when they really try."
"That is great, Skippy," I said with relief. "Tell Major Perkins to congratulate Strebik for us, please."
I knew Skippy would write the message in a way that Perkins could not tell it was coming from a human source.
"Will do, Joe."
I will also tell Major Perkins that Strebik should not go anywhere near the control panel on the far left, because that is for the explosive charges that will blow the soil off the top of the projector and extend the maser cannon's muzzle.
"Please do that," I said seriously.
It was great that Perkins's team had gotten a maser cannon reactivated. It was not great that from the time they got the drill rig initially loaded into the Buzzard, it had taken 4 days. Even with Skippy hacking into the sensors of both Ruhar and Kristang, we needed to get at least 8 projectors online as soon as possible. There was too much risk of Perkins's team being discovered. And we need to think of ways to speed up the whole process. Perkins had told Emby that she was confident future projectors could be activated much quicker now that her crew knew how to get a drill rig to a site and how to operate it. And I don't know how many times we can ask Strebik to squeeze down that tiny hole. If I did that, my nerves would be shot. And she needs to fly that Buzzard. We can't risk her having a nervous breakdown.
"Oh, that's not a problem, Joe. Next time I'll explain to Major Perkins how to make the big drill bit oscillate so it creates a larger diameter hole. Your buddies Cornpone and Ski should fit down there easily."
"What? Why the hell didn't you tell them that this time?"
"Truthfully, I didn't consider the difficulty of one of you monkeys squeezing down a hole like that. I don't have physical limitations, so I didn't think of it. That's supposed to be your job, Joe. We could have told them to oscillate the drill bit this time, but they already had the hole open, and making the hole larger would have required as much time as drilling a second hole."
"Crap." He was right. It was my job to think of practical issues.
"My bad. Yes, please inform Perkins about how to drill a bigger hole in the future. Strebik should be happy about that. How's the weather forecast?"
"I suggested to Major Perkins that her team move with alacrity, because I am expecting rather strong thunderstorms tomorrow. It would behoove them to get the drill assembled and the slaying operation completed as quickly as possible."
"Alacrity? Behoove? Really, Skippy?"
"Hey, Joe, Major Perkins has a master's degree that your army paid for, and unlike you, she paid attention in high school. It would be good for you to expand your vocabulary sometimes, Colonel Joe."
"Whatever. You knock that Kristang battle group out of the sky and I'll let you teach me one new word every day. Deal?"
"Seems like I'm doing a lot more work than you, but I accept."
"Uh-oh, Joe, we are running out of time," Skippy announced. "We need to strike today."
"What? Only 4 projectors have been activated. You told us that Perkins needs to get 8 online at minimum. Why the rush?"
"Circumstances have changed. I have new information. The Kristang commander is feeling confident in his control of Paradise, so he has scheduled a war game to commence later today, in about 9 hours. Ships will soon begin dispersing to participate in the attack, and we will lose the ability to hit them."
"Crap. We can attack with only 4 projectors?"
"Oh yeah, Joe, it's certainly not ideal, but it will work well enough. The 4 that are active now will be sufficiently effective against the battle group for an initial attack. It is for follow-on defense that we will need to have more projectors to provide full coverage. The only downside to our hastily planned attack is that the commander of the Kristang Task Force is not aboard his command ship right now. He came down to Paradise yesterday in order to investigate a bizarre accident. It seems that a dropship crashed and resulted in blowing up most of a Kristang airbase."
"Huh. That is bizarre." I rolled my eyes. "I wonder how that happened."
"I have no idea, Joe.
That is a puzzle for sure.
Anyway, when Admiral Kikrondo left the wrecked airbase, he is really pissed about it, by the way, he flew up to a destroyer instead of the command ship. We
We need to take out the command ship first. It represents a significant portion of their combat power. I will hit Kikrondo's destroyer if I can. I wouldn't count on it.
I am sure this Kikrondo guy will not be heartbroken if you are not able to target the destroyer he is on.
Good point. Hey, I can send him a sorry that we missed you card.
Let's not and say we did.
With only 4 projectors online, their area of coverage was limited. Each projector could only shoot within a cone of about 28 degrees. Perkins's team had activated 4 projectors that were close to each other in order to bring projectors online as quickly as possible. While that made sense in terms of logistics, it meant there were huge areas of the sky we couldn't hit. Skippy could only guarantee to hit 8 ships, 14 at the most. The Krestang ships were varying their patrol patterns to prevent the Ruha Commodore from being tempted into an opportunistic raid. We did have an advantage, if we had time to use it. Each Krestang warship was assigned a patrol route by the command ship in order to coordinate their coverage of the planet's surface. Most of the communication was from the command ship's computer to the other ship's navigation computers, so the crews were not directly involved in most cases. Skippy had been able to gain limited access to the Krestang command ship's computer. He used that access to alter the patrol patterns. Although the patrol routes were supposed to be random, there was logic to them. The method of assigning patrol routes was to prevent too many ships from being bunched together, because that left gaps in coverage and made the task force an easy target. The challenge for Skippy was to get as many Krestang ships within the strike cones of our 4 projectors before some alert Krestang realized something was very wrong. Mathematically, he figured the best he could do was bring 14 ships within our strike cones at any one time. I told him not to try for the perfect solution. That carried too much risk of the enemy being alerted and blowing our whole plan. If Skippy could get a dozen ships in the virtual crosshairs of our projectors, he was to tell me immediately so I could press the big red button on my Z-phone. And if there was any sign the Krestang were catching on to our plan, we were going to shoot right away. Even with the Krestang ships flying unaltered patrol routes, there were usually 6 or 7 ships within the strike cones at any one time. Even the awesome power of the projectors would not allow us to clear enemy ships from the skies over Paradise if those ships had been ready for our attack. If those ships had the defensive shields active, even the searing power of a projector's maser beams might be deflected long enough for the ships to perform an emergency jump. Lightly protected ships like frigates would be no match for the power of a projector, but a Krestang destroyer might survive long enough to jump to safety, and a cruiser or battle cruiser could potentially deflect even 2 shots before being forced to jump away. With only 4 projectors to work with, we couldn't afford to use 2 projectors on 1 ship. Fortunately, we had the laws of physics on our side. Ships not engaged in battle could not maintain their shields at full power all the time. Defensive shields drained a significant amount of power from a ship's reactor. In the case of a small ship like a frigate, the ship had to decrease shield power temporarily in order to fire its maser cannon. Shield generators also wore out and became polarized from long-term use, so the Krestang ships around Paradise had their ships in low power mode to protect the ships only from being struck by space debris. Since shield generators could be brought to full power in seconds, and a ship would be warned of Ruha ships attacking by the telltale gamma ray burst, the Krestang felt safe leaving their shields at low power. And that meant their ships in the skies above Paradise were sitting ducks. All 4 projectors fired simultaneously to maximize the surprise. 2 of the maser cannons had clear skies above. Another had high, thin cloud cover that was no obstacle to the maser projecting its full power above the atmosphere. The 4th projector was somewhat unlucky. It was under a heavy layer of cloud cover, but at least the clouds were not pouring down rain. The heavy layer of clouds was no match for that maser cannon. It had been designed to shoot through clouds. Its initial shot was a rapid series of low-powered pulses that lanced up through the clouds, the searing heat of the maser pulses boiling away the water vapor and leaving a brief, narrow, clear channel all the way up through the cloud. 0.5 millisecond later, the maser put out its full power into the clear tunnel of air, striking a Krestang destroyer. The projector followed a shoot-shoot-look pattern, with 2 full-power shots followed by a lower-power maser scan of the target. Satisfied that the Krestang destroyer was now a wreck, the projector shifted its aim to a second target, first shooting a rapid series of pulses to knock aside the clouds in that direction. The very first target struck in the engagement was the command ship, the battlecruiser, "He who pushes aside fear shall always be victorious." The maser cannon that targeted that ship a maser shooting up through a crystal-clear sky, did not care if the ship's crew pushed aside fear or not. It also followed a standard shoot-shoot-look pattern. The first pulse lasted 0.2 milliseconds and sliced through the unprotected ship's hull. With the Victorious moving at nearly 3 kilometers per second, the maser beam did not need to move its aim. The ship did the work of cutting itself almost in half as it moved through the path of the maser bolt. One area the first maser pulse burned through was a missile magazine that was the projector's primary target. 5 missiles exploded, sending shrapnel in every direction and rupturing the ship's hull from inside. That first maser shot would have been enough to turn the Victorious from a powerful warship into a drifting hulk, but the projector was not finished. Shrapnel from the exploding missiles had not even time to reach the aft of the ship when the second maser pulse of the shoot-shoot-look pattern targeted the battlecruiser's reactor, and an instant later a brief new sun shone in the sky high above Paradise. When the maser shifted into its lower-powered look mode, the largest piece of organized matter where the Victorious had been was about the size of a dropship. Remorselessly, the projector shifted to the second in the list of targets it had been given by an alien AI. Less than a second later, that target also exploded because a direct maser hit to the ship's jump drive capacitors released that stored energy. The maser projector then changed aim to a third target, automatically calculating how much energy from its rapidly draining capacitors would be needed for the shot.
"Done!" Skippy shouted triumphantly a few seconds later. "Scratch 12 targets! Damn, I am good!"
"We may be able to hit another ship in a couple seconds. It's at a bad angle right now, but in a few..."
"No, damn it, the stupid thing just jumped away."
"Oh well, you can't have everything." "Joe, tell me the truth. Am I awesome, or am I awesome?"
"Between those two excellent choices, I will choose awesome, Skippy. I would have celebrated your awesome awesomeness without prompting. And you are not just good. You are the best ever. How could any being be more awesome than you?" "Okay, maybe I was laying the praise on a little thick."
"I will accept your praise graciously, woefully inadequate though it is. You are doing the best your puny monkey brain can do to marvel at my awesomeness."
I had to laugh. "You are such an asshole sometimes, but I love you anyway. And I find you mostly almost tolerable, Joe."
"I appreciate that. You got a sit rep for us?"
"Affirmative on the sit rep, Colonel," Skippy said in a sarcastic tone. He hated military acronyms.
"We hit 14 ships, and all 14 ships were completely destroyed. That includes their battlecruiser and both cruisers. Only 2 ships even had time to start charging their defensive shield projectors, and that didn't do them any good. It would be easier to list which ships the Kristang have left than to list the ones we destroyed."
"Understood. Go ahead."
"The Kristang have 10 warships remaining, 5 destroyers and 5 frigates. On the Ruhar side, the ships that are combat-ready are 1 cruiser, 3 destroyers, and 2 frigates. That cruiser would seem to give the Ruhar a slight advantage, but the Kristang design philosophy for destroyers makes them more like the equivalent of a Ruhar light cruiser. The Kristang still have the advantage of combat power."
"Yeah, but we have the projectors," I reminded him.
2 of those projectors are now almost depleted, Joe. The remaining power is inadequate to penetrate the shields of a starship, even if we fired both of those projectors at the same target. Each of the other 2 healthy projectors are capable of 1 shot each. They could destroy a ship if we fired both at the same target. Unfortunately, those 2 projectors are poorly positioned to hit the same target. The enemy ship would need to be within a very small slice of the sky for the projectors to have line of sight to it. That won't happen, because now that the enemy knows where at least 4 of our projectors are, their ships will avoid the space covered by them."
"Yeah," I said, looking at Adams.
"We need to get Perkins working on activating that other projector as soon as she can. Those Kristang ships are sure to test whether those 4 projectors are the only ones active. If we can fire another projector, the Kristang will assume we have capabilities we haven't revealed yet. If they jump in and we can't shoot at them, they'll know that we're bluffing, and then we'll be in deep shit real quick. Skippy, can you provide cover for Perkins if her team needs to work fast? We can't let them wait for night."
"Affirmative, Joe. Without the prying eyes of starships overhead, I can conceal Major Perkins's buzzard from being detected, unless someone happens to eyeball them while they are digging. And when they are done and need to fly away, I can give the pilot a route for maximum concealment. They do still have the problem of needing to refuel before they can reach the next projector site."
"Joe, I do not think we will have much trouble concealing the actions of a lone buzzard."
"Why is that?"
"Because, Joe,
Very soon I expect the skies of a paradise to be filled with Ruhar and Kristang aircraft, fighting the biggest air battle in several hundred years. The Kristang landed over 300 aircraft, plus they captured additional Ruhar aircraft when they took over territory under terms of the ceasefire. The Ruhar have almost 600 aircraft, but they have a civilian population to protect, and more of their aircraft are unarmed civilian transports. Without starships overhead, those aircraft are the best way to establish control over the surface of Paradise. We should expect... Yes. Joe, the Kristang just launched a wave of dropships and aircraft in an attack on two Ruhar air bases. The Ruhar have detected the launch and are scrambling aircraft to intercept. This is going to get ugly very quickly. Sally Chernandigrin walked out of the hangar toward her Dobra fighter. The aircraft she would be flying that day was hers, which wasn't always the case, given how often high-performance Dobras needed to go off the flight line for maintenance. That day, her mission was a simple check ride, to test the thruster unit that had been replaced. It should be a simple, relatively short flight. Although it was only a short flight, the Dobra was fully armed with missiles. While Kristang were still on the move and above the planet, they were technically at war. Neither Saley nor any other Ruhar trusted the Kristang to adhere to the ceasefire agreement.
"Your pet wants a cookie," Jeff Blander said sourly, pointing at Derek Bonsu, who was opening an access cover.
The human, too eager to please, always opened the access covers so that pilots could perform their pre-flight inspections faster. Jeff was Saley's co-pilot and weapons systems officer who sat in the back seat of the Dobra.
"He's not my pet," Saley protested, knowing her words were falling on deaf ears.
Her Wizzo had nothing personal against Derek. Jeff simply did not like humans. Any humans. Like Saley, Jeff was a native to Gitanu. His family on both sides had been on Gitanu for three generations. His entire family had been forcibly evacuated by the humans. Jeff had been scheduled to join them on the trip up the space elevator in little over a month, when the Ruhar fleet arrived and took the planet back.
"You shouldn't be mean to him. We may be leaving this planet if the Kristang stay here, but he is going to die," she said sadly.
"They are not my problem," Jeff said angrily. "They came here with the Kristang."
He stared at the human, his anger softening. The pilot was right. If the Kristang kept Gitanu, the humans eventually would suffer a terrible fate.
"Sally, this is just a check ride," Jeff commented. "Take him instead."
"Are you sure?" Saley asked, surprised.
"Yes."
There was an increasing volume of rumors that the Ruhar federal government was not sending the fleet to fight the Kristang, that Gitanu was not important enough to fight for. If that rumor was true, Derek Bonsu did not have much longer to live. The human had actively assisted the Ruhar, helped to maintain their combat aircraft. The Kristang would find that to be an unforgivable betrayal, and the thin-skinned Kristang never forgave any slight, no matter how minor.
"This may be his last opportunity to fly." "Go," he urged, "before I change my mind."
Chapter 18.
"Your aircraft," Saley announced, releasing the controls.
The Dobra was on autopilot, cruising at only 15,000 meters altitude as measured by humans. Every system had operated perfectly in the flight, including the replacement thruster unit. The only way to test the thruster to its full capabilities was at high altitude, up where the air was so thin that thrusters were needed to control the gunship's flight.
"Take us up."
"Yes, ma'am,"
Derek acknowledged as he deactivated the autopilot and set the controls for the airspeed and altitude that allowed a maximum climb rate. The Dobra zoomed toward the upper edge of the atmosphere, where its engines strained to gulp in enough air to keep the aircraft aloft. Soon, the wings began to lose lift, and Derek needed to push the nose down to maintain airspeed, or the thin air flowing over the wings would cause a stall. A Dobra could hover at up to 20,000 meters. Already, he had the engine pods pointed down slightly so their thrust helped keep the gunship aloft.
"Losing roll control," Derek reported as the wings began to wobble. He had not been this high other than in a simulator for over a year. The Ruhar aircraft flew like a dream. The controls were light and responsive. The ship did everything he asked of it and told him there was more, so much more that it could do and was eager to do. Even at this extreme altitude with the engine straining, when he touched the throttle, he could feel there was reserve power he had not used yet.
If he had not been concentrating so hard on the instruments, he would have had a moment to realize this was the happiest he had been in months. Coming to Paradise, once something Derek had burned with patriotic fervor to do, had become a nightmare. UNEF was trapped. Not even the Kristang had access to Earth. The Expeditionary Force were all prisoners of war, forced to grow their own food. Their allies, the Kristang, had been revealed to be cruel deceivers, caring only about using UNEF and enslaving humanity. Duty for UNEF was now all about survival on a planet with the Ruhar in charge. Now the Kristang were back, and survival might not be possible. If Derek had stopped to think about that, he would plunge into despair. So he thought only of how joyous it was to fly this powerful alien fighter aircraft high above an alien planet. The role was getting worse. A Ruhar pilot, with their genetically enhanced reflexes, might have been able to keep ahead of the aircraft's shuddering, but Derek needed help to halt the rolling tendency before it snapped the Dobra over on its back. He consoled himself with the thought that the purpose of going this high was to test the thruster unit, which he now needed. Engaging thrusters to stabilize. Saley looked at her instruments to monitor the performance of the new thruster unit, which was not actually new. It was a rebuilt unit that had been recovered from a Dobra shot down by her own people, back when a human had been flying the doomed aircraft and the Ruhar fleet came back to retake control of the planet. She would have preferred a truly new thruster unit, but of course, spare parts were no longer being shipped to Gatanu. The thruster was operating perfectly, and Derek had confident control of the aircraft, so she took her eyes away from the instruments for a glance out the canopy. Up this high, the sky was black, and the curve of the planet below was noticeable. It looked so peaceful. The land to the north, so green. The ocean below them, so blue. The cloud tops, so brilliantly white. Above, her eyes caught sunlight reflecting off something, and she blinked to enhance the vision in her helmet visor. A Kristang ship. A big one. The image wobbled enough that she couldn't quite tell if that ship above her was the battle group's command ship, but she thought that likely. If she wanted, she could have viewed the image from one of the Dobra's cameras, but she did not care to see the enemy ship that closely. Her eyes turned back to the instruments, so she missed by a nanosecond the intense white flare coming up from the planet's surface. She knew that she shouldn't look toward a maser beam, but her instincts made her look briefly before her training took over. So she didn't miss the projector's second shot, or the even brighter fireball of that Kristang cruiser exploding. "Engage stealth," Saley ordered calmly as she was momentarily blinded by the intense light of the maser burning its way up through clouds. "Take us down on the deck." Derek did not hesitate. He had not seen the initial maser shot, but caught the second beam out of the corner of his eye. Immediately he had closed his eyes and looked away, so his vision was unaffected. The first thing he did was activate the stealth field, and the bright sunlight coming in through the canopy disappeared as a curtain of darkness draped over the aircraft. From now on, he would be flying entirely on instruments, which did not bother him. When the stealth field had been powered up, long thin wires had extended from each wingtip and the tail. The ends of the wires peeked out beyond the stealth field and provided sensor data. The canopy automatically switched over to provide a view, a composite image of what the sensors said were outside. He did not make the mistake of reducing power, for at that altitude, the Dobra would have stalled and gone into a spin. Thrusters could have recovered from the spin, which the aircraft would have done automatically. But with a shooting war going on above his head, Derek had been trained to reserve thruster fuel. He pointed the Dobra's nose down and felt his body moving upward against the seat straps as the gunship hit the top of the arc, and he was momentarily weightless. Then the sensation of weight gradually returned, and he concentrated on keeping airspeed to VST, the speed for maximum stealth. He had to run the engines at almost minimum power and monitor airflow over the wings so the Dobra passed through the atmosphere as smoothly as possible. The problem with using stealth in an atmosphere was that enemy sensors could track him by the warm, roiling air behind the Dobra. If he had to engage in air combat, stealth would be almost a liability. The engines would be putting out enough heat and turbulent air that he might as well hold up a sign saying, "Shoot me." With the aircraft in a stable descent trimmed for optimal stealth, Derek had time to scan the sensors and assess the situation. He had just turned his attention to the tactical display when another Kristang ship overhead exploded, or a piece of a ship had exploded,
because he could run the display back and see that ship had been struck by a powerful maser beam in the initial strike. Stunned, Derek toggled the display back and expanded the coverage for a wider area. He gasped with shock when he saw what the sensor data revealed. The Krestang battlegroup in orbit had been hit hard by four powerful maser cannons on the surface. Maser cannons.
"You hit the Krestang!"
"Yeah!" Derek shouted and pumped a fist toward the canopy.
"Thank you!"
"That wasn't us," Sally responded tersely. It was the first words they had exchanged since the attack began. She had been monitoring the sensors and communicating with the airbase to find out what in the hell was going on. No one had answers. Ruhar Command appeared to be as surprised as anyone.
"We don't have projectors like that. If we did, we would have used them when the Krestang were raiding us."
"Not you? Then who?" Derek asked, completely confused. "It's not us, is it? UNEF?"
"No, not humans either. I do not know what is going on. Cut the chatter," she ordered.
Derek cut the chatter and turned his focus back to the sensors. He suddenly realized that since the start of the crisis, Saley had trusted him with complete control of the aircraft. Her aircraft.
"We've been ordered to return to base," Saley announced.
"On course," Derek acknowledged. He had assumed that was where Saley wanted to go, so they were already flying in that direction. The check ride was clearly over. Saley must have been happy with his flying because she didn't say anything to him for several minutes. Still flying with maximum stealth, they crossed the shore and were now over land. At their present slow airspeed, the base was 47 minutes away. Derek checked status of the weapons, which Saley had not enabled yet. As a human, Derek knew he was not trusted with weapons. They would return to the airbase, and Saley would likely be reprimanded for flying with an unauthorized weapons system officer. Derek's flying days would be over. It was likely he would soon find himself tending crops in Lemuria. And he didn't care. The Krestang battlegroup was gone. With many of their ships obliterated by powerful maser cannons, they would think very carefully about approaching the planet again. They were free. Humans were free. Or at least free to be prisoner of war under the Ruhar. Derek no longer felt a constant fear of a Krestang sword hanging over his neck.
"No matter what else happened, they..."
"My aircraft," Saley said curtly, and the control stick went slack in Derek's hand.
"Roger that," he replied, and mentally switched back to Wizzo mode.
Since the main battle group had arrived to take control over Pardassus, the Swift Arrow Clan frigate, to seek glory in battle is glorious, had been relieved of her dangerous raiding duties because there were to be no more raids. A ceasefire was in effect, a ceasefire with generous conditions that had shocked the crew of the Glory when they heard about it. Why Admiral Kikrondo had made so many concessions to an enemy whose position was so weak, almost no one in his battle group could understand. Kikrondo had sent a message to all ships that he was following strict instructions from clan leadership. The clan leaders strongly desired a negotiated agreement for the cowardly and treacherous Ruhar to leave Pardassus, Kikrondo had explained, his voice almost choking with outraged disgust as he read the words. Unsaid but implied was that the Swift Arrow Clan's resources were stretched very thin at the moment. With the prospect of a civil war within the Krestang looming, the clan could not afford to support a protracted battle for Pardassus. The cowardly Ruhar civilian government had already agreed to the concept of abandoning, surrendering, the world their military had fought very hard for. All that remained was for the two sides to agree to a price. And now that Kikrondo's powerful battle group had established total supremacy in the space on and around Pardassus, the Swift Arrow leaders were confident they could ultimately get the entire planet for a cheap price. The question of why the Swift Arrow clan wanted a world whose chief product was grain had never been stated. Most of the warriors in the battle group had never been to the backwater world of Pardassus before, and what they saw was not impressive. Looking down at a world dotted here and there with the parallel stripes of agricultural fields, most of the ship's crew considered that the real reason they had been sent on a one-way mission was to uphold the honor of their clan and their entire species. Because there was no other conceivable reason why the clan leadership had sent so much of the clan's precious combat power to such an unimportant planet. The clan leadership was wise, Kikrondo had stated in an unconvincing tone. The brave warriors of the battle group needed to have faith in their leadership and concentrate on executing their mission to the greater honor and credit of the clan.
When the crew of the Glory heard Kikrondo's speech, the little frigate's captain had turned to his executive officer and muttered the Kristang equivalent of blah, blah, blah. Words were passing things, and it mattered not why the battle group was here. What mattered was the mission that had been assigned to the battle group, to each ship and to each crewman. The current mission assigned to the Glory, each and every one of her crew agreed, sucked. It sucked big time. It could have sucked a bowling ball through 50 feet of garden hose, that's how badly it sucked. After taking enormous risks as the chief raiding ship before the bulk of the battle group arrived, the Glory's crew had expected a nice, cushy assignment. The frigate would tie up next to a support ship they expected for extended maintenance and repairs. Maintenance that was long overdue. While engineering teams worked feverishly to bring the frigate back up to full combat potential, most of the crew could enjoy some well-deserved shore leave on the planet they had been viewing from space for so long, but no. That was not their assignment. After the long journey to Perdassus, many of Kikrondo's heavy ships needed maintenance and replenishment, and those much more valuable ships were given priority attention by the support vessels. The battered, worn-out little Glory was given a lonely task, a task for which frigates had been designed. She was to shadow the Ruhar Commodore for Lant's remaining task force. And so, the Glory was positioned roughly 1 light-minute away from Ferlant's loosely clustered ships, 1 minute closer to Perdassus. Ferlant's ships had mostly been sitting in one spot since the ceasefire, licking their wounds and biding their time. Glory's captain considered that no matter how unhappy the warriors of the Swift Arrow Task Force were about their current mission, the Ruhar of Ferlant's task force had to be even more unhappy. They had failed. They had failed to protect their planet from damaging raids by a handful of isolated Kristang ships, and now they had completely lost control of the star system. What awaited Ferlant's crews was a humiliating wait for negotiations to conclude, and then a retreat with their tails tucked between their legs. If the Ruhar crews had been Kristang warriors, it would be a long time, if ever, before they could hold their heads in anything but utter shame. A Kristang would enthusiastically embrace death before enduring such dishonor. Or so the Kristang told themselves with bravado while they had such an overwhelming advantage in combat power around Perdassus. While their little ship performed its lonely picket duty, keeping an eye on Ferlant's impotent ships, the Glory's crew went about fixing up the ship as best they could. With the ship technically being constantly at battle stations, they could not take many critical systems offline for badly needed maintenance. So they did what they could, and waited for relief. Surely Admiral Kikrondo's staff would send another frigate to replace the Glory eventually, and the ship could be returned to full combat capability. Surely that would happen soon.
"Signal received," the ship's communications officer shouted excitedly. "The order is option... green?"
The man sputtered in surprise.
"We are to execute immediately!"
Concealing his shock and resigned to his fate, the ship's captain gave the order with a calm due more to weariness than bravery.
"Execute Plan Green as soon as possible," he said sadly to his executive officer.
"Yes, Captain,"
the man replied quietly, and turned to engage the ship's poorly maintained jump drive system.
"The condition of the drive is..."
"I know,"
the captain said without taking his eyes off the tactical display.
"Do the best you can. We must jump as quickly as possible."
"The best possible,"
the executive officer said while studying the indicators for jump drive coil status.
"We'll barely get there in time."
The signal from Perdassus had continued past the Glory and would reach the Ruhar task force in less than 1 minute. Presumably, the Ruhar on the planet had sent their own signal to Commodore for launch ships. If the Glory were to have any advantage of surprise, she needed to arrive in the midst of the Ruhar formation before the signal did.
"Understood," the captain acknowledged.
He could read the drive status on his own display. He turned the attention to the officer monitoring the sensor console.
"What happened down there?"
Option green was one of 5 contingencies established by Admiral Kikrondo, with green being a plan to be activated only if the battle group somehow suffered a catastrophic loss. How could that have happened? The officer had been frantically pushing buttons and spinning dials. Confused and shocked, he looked up from the console.
"Captain, it appears the Ruhar violated the ceasefire. They attacked our battle group using projectors."
"Projectors?"
The captain exchanged an astonished look with his executive officer.
You are certain?
The Glory's sensors were in poor condition and far overdue for important components to be replaced. There must be a mistake. A sensor glitch.
Yes, Captain, there is no mistake. I can clearly see three projectors firing, and another is behind the curve of the planet's horizon.
Projectors, the captain repeated.
When did the Ruhar install projectors? How? They did it right under our noses?
Fleet intelligence will have a difficult time explaining this,
the executive officer noted.
We have lost 11 ships so far, including the Victorious. She was struck first. The attack is continuing. Or it was, he added,
remembering that the light picked up by the ship's sensors was now several light minutes old.
11 ships, the captain said, stunned.
This was indeed a catastrophic event. A disaster for the battle group and for the Swift Arrow clan. He now understood why Kakrondo ordered Option Green. The order called for the Glory to abandon her picket duty, jump into the midst of the Ruhar formation, and attack. Attack and cause as much damage as she could until she was disabled or destroyed. Option Green called for Little to seek glory in battle as glorious, to fight to the death.